you have the net. We send two guys over to the first Marines, and two guys to 7th, two guys to 11th, and two guys to the 5th Marine. And we divide it up. And so we set a time that I'll be talking on that frequency to 7th Marines, or anybody whoever has the message. So anyway, it was about 9 o'clock at night. We got on the island about 4 o'clock in the evening, and it was 9 o'clock. We still hadn't settled down. We still haven't talked yet. So he gave us permission to talk. And I called the 7 Marines and tell them that I have met a message for them, that they're supposed to withdraw their second battalion, withdraw and move to the right. I don't know how many feet it was. Anyway, this guy answered. He's dead now, by the way, Sam Begay. I just heard that he died just 2 years ago. But he and I, we fought from San, June, we talk on there. And before we finished talking, the phone rang. He answered, said there's somebody on the frequency. And another radio called, and about 5 more runners came in. The Jets had taken over everything. They're talking in frequency. We can't understand what the hell they're saying. And the colonel, he was explaining that, calm down, calm down. These are our own men talking. They're sending valuable messages, and you cannot interfere in them. But still, the call kept coming in, kept coming. The Jets are on our frequency. We want to change to certain days, change the code to certain days. They go by days, they change every day, on the hour. And somehow the Jet has gotten our code, and they're talking on our frequency. And boy, the colonel didn't know whether to send us back or leave us there. He said, you guys are more trouble than he said, I was sitting here nice and cozy in the tent. Now I have to go and tell everybody else that I can't say anything on the air about that. He said that I have to tell them it's our own men, but what kind of men you guys are? That's how we got started. So when the colonel had an idea, I said, I'll keep you on one condition, that you can outrace my coat, my white coat. They have a cylinder like thing. You set it, you set codes on it, and then you send it on radio with a tick, 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 and send it over there. And the other end receives it, and he sends back that he got it. He gets the Roger for it. So he sent a message there. He got a message, and I got a message. Then he started rolling. I said, you ready? He said, oh, I've started already. when are you going to get through? He says, about 2 hours. 2 hours, I can get this thing over in 2 minutes. Give you a head start. I got the radio while he's still mucking on his coding machine. I got the radio, and I called all units that this message was going to all units. And I got a Roger on all the four units in about 4.5 minutes. The colonel, he timed us. He says it's 4 minutes and 29 seconds, 4 minutes and 30 seconds. That was the last rider right there. So, and this guy, this white guy, he was still coding. Yeah, the unit already got their message. We already knew they got it. He's still in the sand. I said, Colonel, when you going to get him off the signal outfit? The man was more efficient than he ever was. So he didn't say anything. He just light up his pipe and went away. He was still scratching his head. He don't hear this. Nobody still don't know. You guys are reading the papers that too many people are learning nowadays. That we can't decode anyone of them. You can't decode it. You got to go to school for it, memorize it, and throw away your papers and whatever you learn. You just put it up here and walk around the code. Thank you. identify him, we're going to take him back. So I said, come on, let's go. I didn't know I was ready to go. Finally, the lieutenant came around. He said, what you guys, what's the matter? And so we caught this man over there in our yard. And we think he's a Jap. If you guys don't identify him, we're going to go back and shoot him. Kind of got wise, and they, I said, well, okay, he's one of our boys, and we'll take care of him. So they got me back, and they got this guy, white guy, we call white guy. They gave me, he was my bodyguard. I went everywhere. I go everywhere. He'd come right behind me. And I go to the hit. I go swimming. He goes swimming. He done everything I did. I went to that move out there, beach. I just sat there. They had that bombing raid. I couldn't move no more. Everybody took off into the hill. I just sat there until everybody came back. Well, that's how we got started. I don't mean to take over the whole work, but that's been in my mind ever since. I don't know. I keep telling everybody that there's a white man that's been teaching that guy something. I never seen him. He and I, we don't know each other. And it's the first time I thought I had met him. I kept looking at the cards around here, and finally they got him right here back. He says he's an old friend. I guess we gained a friend, they gained a friend. Well, they don't even say anything to them when they gain a friend. These are friends that took for granted. That's the way we are. We just take for granted. When we get to gain a friend, well, he's my friend, Only their own friends sometimes cut their throat. Then it's too late to know what happened. But I think Mr. Johnson's been very, very helpful to the Navajo people after we have gone through. I don't mean to do any belittling him or anything, but that's just how we got started. And we wanted the truth, and that's the truth. And I'm not going to deviate from what I've said. What I said is the absolute, and then some of the things that are more worse than what I told you has happened. That's besides the point. And I sure thank the medium for that. I know you've done a good work with the Navajos up to PFC ranking.
That was William McCabe.
Went low,
We knew they had the bracket. We didn't have time to encode a Navajo language message. We did use voice radio part of the time when we weren't sending important messages, but we sent a frantic message in English. Lift the fire, we've occupied the old Jap position. But you know the Japs have tried that trick themselves before. They can speak as perfect English as anyone with just the correct accent from any part of the country. And the artillery commander was skeptical of this English message coming over. So he said, do you have a Navajo? Well, they found the Navajo and he sent the message over in code that they had, in fact, occupied the old Japanese position. The fire was lifted then and there. This young man said, we'd have certainly been clobbered in the next round or two if that message hadn't gotten through. And that's how they saved my life. Now, Martin, how much longer do we have, Martin? Is this the end of it? I thought we had a half hour.
Yeah. Can we...
Set by the weather that day, we threw it all out, and in the aisle and said, well, that is not the way to fix a bed. He said, fix it the way I showed you last night. So we fixed our beds about five times that day. But this is the real, the important part of this is this, that we have never been subjected to any type of military rule, or we just come right off the chief country and directly into the military life. And this was so shocking to us. So when we went to bed that evening, someone, I'm not going to say who he is, but I woke up in the middle of the night, I heard the sniffing, a little moaning, crying, the guy was talking and stuff. He just wondered how in the world he ever got the volunteer. We weren't drafted, incidentally. We were volunteers. They called for Navajo volunteers, and we volunteered and went in. And this kid, he was crying, and he was talking himself, and how in the world he got the Marine Corps. But we had lots of fun, though, at one other life story. And one of our sergeants always, he thought he was quite a boxer, and pretty well able and quick with his fists. So we got to boxing one another, and he had a whole bunch of boxing gloves. And he didn't like the way we were boxing. We were light people. We were not aggressive in any nature. We were always peaceful. We never did fight one another, but they made us box. So we were pretending like we were boxing real hard, and he said, hell no, there's no way to box. So he lined us up. One at a time, he hit. We were falling all over. This is one instance. Carl, I must have had some kind of training in boxing. When that sergeant there fat, old Carl was kidding. That was the last of our boxing matches. Of the training at one time there, the airport was right next to Marine Corps base, and we got this big military parade ground, and you couldn't hear the commands when they were given when one of these planes go by. But anyway, the command was given for the rear march. We were in columns of three. And I think we're the first six guys up in the front didn't hear the command. And so we, the rest of us, made the march to the rear. And these six men kept walking down. So he called a halt, we halt, these six men, or three guys, kept walking on down the parade ground. So the sergeant had to run up there and tell them to halt. So they halted, and it was about place. We made it out late, and they looked around and said, where's the rest of the troop? And so these six boys, he said, these three deaf Indians can't hear the command. I don't know what they're here for, and so they ought to be sent home. These people, these guys thought they would be ready. They didn't want to go home. I wonder if there'd be one of those guys that was sniffing and crying with one of them. He thought, he really going to get to go home. Not about this side of the story, but I just wanted to put that in there. We'll be here together the next 2 days, and I appreciate seeing a lot of you people, and we don't want to get any of the stories.
Ceremonial song. Now, one of them was the rabbit. and in those days, cottontails were plentiful. Long about noon, when he and the dogs got hungry, they'd go out and hunt these rabbits, chase them out of the bushes they were lying under, and they would run up into the rocks and get into a hole. Then the herder boy had a long wand. He twisted up in the rabbit's fur and pulled it out, maybe two or three of them, and roast it and build the fire and roast it, and he'd give the dogs each a little bite of it. So when they were all getting hungry and time to go out and hunt rabbits, why, the Indian boy, which is Navajo boy, would sing this song.
Bay, bay, naho, lahala, what, bekeh, ikadi, ash, yo, oho, hey, ne, howling, ahaway, 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 ahaway,
there's more to come. I said I had three songs. The two other songs were picked up by the Navajo, little Navajo children around Tolshaco.
Don't talk about death. I shut up. I didn't come here to Besides.
The seven Marines, he said, he means today.
That was Carl Gorman.
And I was talking to Teddy Draper. I forgot to ask him what he does now. And we're out now at the barbecue, and he's going to tell me.
Well, my position is adult education. Adult educator, I call it instructor. I teach basic math, basic English, social, current event.
With the Bevel Community College?
No, this will be out in the field.
Oh, so I see.
We try to get these people try to write their names, they're using their phone. Write their name, try to read the prices at the store, and try to read the pounds, and how to read the pounds, how to count money, how to make changes.
Yeah.
This is what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
So
it is really a literacy.
Yeah, it's a literacy.
It's literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Well, the older people.
Okay.
And then there.
And who sponsors it? Does the
college.
The college sponsors it.
Mm-hmm. And well, we have about close to 500 students. Five of them are working out in the field, and we have five assistant instructors and one project leader. And many farmers. That's about 17 miles north of us.
Well, how much time do you spend out in the field? How every day?
No.
5 days a week?
At Chin Lee, I have Tuesday and Thursday. And then I was leaning. I go there on Monday and Wednesday. There'll be 2 days in the morning. Just in the morning, but at Chin Lee, we have full day on Thursday.
I see. Now, do the people come in groups?
They come in the morning. People,
yeah.
And we're telling them to come at 9 o'clock on Tuesday. They come in.
I'm going to ask you about
Neva?
Neva. Mr. Sandoval, I'm going around with my little tape recorder here so I don't have to write all this down. Which division are you? You were with the 4th?
The 14th Division.
And
24th Regiment.
And where did you serve?
Well, we started from Marshall Islands. The squadron, I'm on
Roy
Nemours, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Saipan after that. And then on to Tinian. And then to Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
That was our last campaign.
Now, since you were with the 4th, you weren't with the very first Code Talkers, were you?
No, I was quite young. I didn't make the first.
Did you, how old were you when you went in?
I was about 16. 16.
Isn't that amazing? So many were so young.
Yes, well, they more or less brought the age up, you know. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to do at the time, you see, the record wasn't kept accurately, you mm-hmm. see. So some of these people like Teddy here, you know, they come up, pick up, you're onto the edge of the gutter, you know. I could have gotten in if my teacher hadn't saw me, you know. I was in line, you know, for the recruiting.
Oh.
But really just about come up to the recruiting table, sergeant there, you know, teacher, you know. Peter, you are there, you're doing in there, you know.
Oh.
She met me out. You know.
And it broke your heart. Because
well,
all the boys
yes.
were leaving and you didn't get to go.
All my classmates get to go.
Well, one thing that, see, the book is written,
mm-hmm.
and the reason I'm out here is that I wasn't quite satisfied with two chapters, chapters 10 and 11, which had to do with the Navajo as a Marine
mm-hmm.
and his experiences, actual experiences in combat with the
mm-hmm.
code. I have all the history and everything, and so I'm asking all the men about the same questions, if there was any particular instance that you remember when the code came in mighty handy,
mm-hmm.
you know, for your outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any particular, they all say anecdotes, I don't want, that's not the word. It's just, if you can remember a time when it was really important to use the code.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it was more or less a normal thing, you see. The word has spread out throughout the division, you know, that there is such thing as Code Talkers. By that time, the first bunch went in, more or less, they were there for a special assignment. Nobody knew, you know, what they were supposed to do and so on.
It's Mr. McCabe, the first thing.
Yes, right. But afterwards, you see, Johnny, the one that spoke after him, yeah, he came back to recruit, and this sort of perfect the code. And from then on, it has a more systematic to it, you see. And still, we had a little problem talking with the older people that went ahead of us. And then even some of those veterans, you know, from 1st Division, 2nd Division, they came back and formed the other division. It was kind of a little problem, you know, in communicating. They had a different set of codes. And
they had
yes. But through conversation, you know, a little explanation, you know, we were able to get through.
Mm-hmm.
When I went in, which was towards the latter part, you know, like I said, you know, 14th Division was the last original division that was formed. And the other two divisions, 5th and 6th, were composed of the veterans, you know, from the earlier division.
Oh,
so, yes, I'm more or less, it was a going thing, you know, at the time. More or less fit in. And the staff, you know, the general staff, they're familiar, you know, they know what we're there for. And even then, sometimes, you see, the Navy had a name, a Code Talker also, which is a person, you know, that has to do with coding, I guess.
Oh, I see.
So sometimes they call for us for Code Talkers, you know, and the confusion starts over. They didn't know, you know, whether they want to explain, you know, what Code Talkers were talking about. And of course, it was secret, you see, they can't say, put a Navajo speaking person on. We would put on, like during the landing, somebody said we could put on a battleship, you know, and we would communicate from ship to shore, or from air to ground.
From ground to
ground.
Ground,
to
air. Ground.
Yeah. So it was a going thing there, and we learned a lot about the experience, you know, of earlier people that went that they could give us ideas. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty well established and going when we got there. So it was sort of more or less a routine thing, you know, by the time we got there.
Even though it was routine, there were certain, well, romantic, there were times when it was quite necessary to have a where they were shelling their own people and tell them all the whole message went back, that right. They had moved. And can you remember any instances similar to that?
No, I don't recall, you know, any incident like that.
Mm-hmm.
My experience was more or less the routine.
I see.
But they still, where expediency is happening, you know, I mean, if they want to attempt to dismiss this right now, they use it.
Yeah.
But if a message would take a little time, but then they go ahead and code it. You know.
And then decode it if they had time.
Yeah, for I see. But for, like in that instant, you know, I lift the fire, you know, in case like this from the wind would come out.
It had to be done right now.
Mm-hmm.
He said in 2 seconds, there you go. It could be
all right.
This is another question that I usually ask. How do you evaluate the contribution of the Navajo code to the, at least the shortening of the campaign in the South Pacific? You know that the code helpers couldn't do it alone, and the Navy couldn't do it alone, and it does have to be a combination.
Mm-hmm.
But do you feel the contribution was a great one?
I feel it is quite a great contribution, yes. As to what degree, you know, it shortened the war.
Anybody own this green, light green Rambler?
Yeah, a contribution is great. I sincerely believe that, yes. I think we did that share, you know, and we're proud. But insofar as a contribution towards shortening the war, you know, I hesitate to say, you know.
Well,
I don't think anybody would
agree. No, nobody would agree with that.
Right.
Except as you saw it working and could see how, the movements could be faster maneuvers and so forth because of the rapidity of the messages being sent.
Well, after we get to, got familiar with this setup and so on, you know, we could just go on the air and tell the other people. Just like in education class, I'm in education right now, you know. I'm comparing, you see, the experience military way of doing things and, you know, in terms of sending messages. And then our way of communicating is faster. And in education also, you see, if we educate our Indian children in terms of the American traditional system, it's very slow, you see. So if we can educate our students in our way, in an American way, it will certainly speed up the learning process, I do believe. You know, using such things as English as a second language. But it has some drawback, you know, but at the beginning, you know, it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So things like this is one example that there are other things, you know, other techniques that we can use, you know, education-wise, that would speed up our learning process for the children.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what do you do in education? Are you counseling? Are you directly teaching? What are you doing?
I am a teacher by profession, and I have some experience in counseling. But right now, I'm a head of guidance department, director of guidance.
I thought that was what you got your
name at Johnson. Yes, the boarding school that we have at New Point, you see, it's a boarding school, not the same way. and we have dumpsters there. And we have food and stuff all the time. So we have, our guidance program is a little different than what you would normally find in the office. So I'm the head of that program. I have about 80 personnel in this program. And we're trying to put this community education concept into effect. This is what I'm doing right now.
Very good. I think that covers it.
Yeah, this is some of the things, the traits that we have, you know, that we don't take things personally. You know, if we take claims, you know, we just take it for a tribe or a group. You know. In the case of Ali Hayes, you know, but he was the only one of three that came out alive, you know, that raised the flag on the OG. One out of five. Three out of five.
Three out of five, and he was one of the three.
Three, yes. Uh-huh. And while he was being taken around, you know, on bond for, you know, everybody praised him and presented gifts to him and so on. He got took it personally, you know. He thought they were praising him personally, you know. And what he never did understood and accepted was the fact that he was representing the Marines, you see. And it never got through to him, you know. He always took it as a person which he just couldn't take it. He just wouldn't accept it. And a lot of people, this is what drove him to drinking, you see. This is what drove him. He kept on saying, you know, that he was not the one to raise the flag, that he was not the hero, you know. And it's not sense make him the hero. Yeah. But this is a tradition with the American people, you see. It's a symbol, you know, like a flag, you see. And this is what causes the vision. Ira Hayes never really understood that. You see, had he understood it and accepted it, you know, he would have been a great man. He could have utilized it, and there was an opportunity for him, you see. But he never did accept it, right. He just didn't quite understood it, or he just couldn't accept it, so he started drinking and finally ended up in his death. No, he was with the Pima tribe, Pima in the Sierra.
Oh, that's right. Where did he live? Where was this?
Well, he'd been around different places, you know. It kind of haunted him, I guess, after the war was over. You know, he's been a different place in drinking in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
One place after another, you know, and finally towards the end, you know, he got back with his own people, and his own people didn't accept him, so by that time he was very bad off, you know,
yeah. Yeah.
So he more or less went out on his own, you know.
And rejected by his family.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that made me, while you were talking about Ira Hayes, made me think a question that I have asked. And I've got some beautiful trauma. What did religion, the Navajo religion, play any part in your feeling about combat? Or did you have any ceremonies before you went, after you came back, for purification?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I think it's wonderful. I think it's something that we could benefit.
Right. The Navajos, you know, are famous for raiders, you know. A lot of the army tactics, you know, and raiders' techniques that they use probably came from the Indian people.
Yeah.
The Navajo people, you know, go out, maybe in groups of three or five, surprise attacks, you know, go out, steal horses, and come out. And before they go out there, they have a ceremony. You know, It's a song, it's a ceremony where it's called, you know, that you, when you go hunting, you know, on your first experience on hunting, you get this buck right, you know, and you had that experience. First experience, you know. when they confront the flock, you know, they just they aim like this here and they just freeze back in the they never in that after shot. Well, a similar a ceremony would cause the same effect, you know. When you meet up face to face with an enemy, an enemy will draw deep on you, the arrow. But that flight or something will freeze that man, that enemy, just long enough for you to take out. So there's a ceremony for this. And they perform the ceremony just before you go overseas. So out in combat, you know, when you come into a situation like that, you know, when you between face to face with an enemy, you have this edge over him, you see. He would momentarily hold his rifle or bayonet or whatever it is, give you a chance, you know, to shoot or a round of ammunition or give you a chance to bring it. And this is the ceremony that usually, I guess most of these veterans that came back had this performed on them before they went over.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them that left, you know, while they were still in school for injury, their families performed this on them before they left. And some of them do have some songs, you know, more or less a protection song. And they quietly sing this to themselves, you know, when they come time for them to land, they sing songs quietly to themselves. You know. So they feel confident, you know, go ashore and
you're like a friend.
Do your confidence, do your feeling, you know, that nothing will happen to you. You know. I guess it's the same feeling that you have. You know, the Franciscan Fathers give out, you know, these medal of St. Christopher. If you have it on the trial, you know, you feel comfortable with it. That sort of feeling I never knew. I never really understood, you know, but this is what happened. And then after they come back, you know, they go to another ceremony. They're supposed to do
like
it.
Anyway.
Well, if you don't have this, they call it score dance. It's enemy, you know, mm-hmm.
It's
enemy,
right, score dance
are
the same.
Right, yes.
And I use it interchangeably in the book, and mm-hmm. I wanted to be sure.
Well, it's the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is to leave the bad experience, you know, the bad thing, the experience that you encounter in combat, that you're supposed to leave it behind, you see. If you don't have this enemy done for you when you come back, eventually it'll haunt you, you see. I guess it's psychosomatic.
Yes, I think so.
It leads you to drinking, you know, it prevents you from concentrating, so on, you see. And so as soon as they come back, they perform the ceremony for them, you see. So they go about their way, you know, as nothing happens.
I've talked to a female who told me the similar things like this. Now, I understand that it is the anyway, this is done. That sometimes you bring back something you've taken from the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and this is used by the medicine man in the ceremony.
In the ceremony process, yes. It's something, you know, like a glut of meaning, or a piece of uniform, just being there. And there was some of the veterans, they brought it back as a souvenir, you see, but they didn't know how valuable it was, you see, in the ceremony.
Okay.
And things like this are not available anymore, you see, until the veterans of World War II came back,
yeah,
with a lot of these souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
We look upon it as a souvenir, you see, but then the medicine man saw it differently, you see. Here was a thing. In addition to that, kind of the
paraphernalia
that
he used. Along with his children. Then did he return it? Would he return it again?
He would return it or he would keep it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what happened, if a veteran has say like a grandfather or a medicine man come to his family, like an uncle, he would just present it to the man, the medicine man, because he would have a far greater use of that material than the veteran has.
I said, now did you bring back anything?
I did. I brought some bullets and bayonets and some armaments, you know, but I've been moving for so much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're all gone now.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have a 14 individual album, you know, that we got.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. I don't have it anymore. No, I don't have anything in that.
Well, I think that I'm so glad you
got it. I see a value in metal hospital. there may be nothing to it. But by the same token, you know, why is the button negotiated with that fighter for an animal? Just for a man after. And we have medicine man. We go to medicine man, you know, and he performs certain things for us to see from there. We convince ourselves we're normal again and we go along.
Yeah. So much
energy.
I think it's been a Catholic experience, certain kind of family. I'm not a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, but some of the things that Catholics do are similar in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best things you can do, that's the best, and then they go away and they've left all this behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's partly for mental health.
Mm-hmm.
When I was here before, I talked to Jim Wilson, and he said that he had a feeling that actually the fact that there's a whole family and maybe somebody contributed to this thing and there's a sense of unity and oneness and togetherness,
mm-hmm.
That you're back reunited with the tribe after having been away.
Mm-hmm.
And from that standpoint, it was tremendously helpful psychologically.
Yes, yes.
So I think that's not very interesting. Well, I see I'm going to have to write and write on chapter 10 and 11.
Where is it? Yeah. I was John Brown Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And you were you were in the first 29.
Yes, ma'am.
And you were in the second division.
Mm.
All right. Now when you went across, where did you go to first? Where did you serve first?
We first went to Guadalcanal.
Yes, that's what
mm-hmm.
I thought. Mm-hmm.
Water Canal. We stayed there. I imagine it was close to a year. And then we moved back to New Zealand just for a week. And then we moved, I think it's somewhere in the Marshall Islands. And then we moved back to New York for a residence.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we came back to Hawaii. And then we moved on to the Battle of Frost.
Oh, that was a bad one.
It was a bad one. If I remember correctly, my group, two of them is dead, the original Navajos that I was with. Their names were Benjamin Cleveland. He is among the 29. He was in my group. 2nd Marine Division, 2nd Signal Company.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dead, Benjamin Cleveland. And the other one was Roy Spigate. He was among the 29. He was also with my crew. He's dead, too. And there was another one, Lowell Damon. He is now living in Fort Defiance. Him and me are the only one that's living out of the 2nd Signal Company that they use as a coat cover. Of course, some of them entered the 4th Marine Division, and some of them went to 1st Marine Division after our training was completed in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
We just called it Navajo, we just called it Tepa.
Oh, yeah.
Navajo.
Instead of having the word for S and U and R and so forth,
mm-hmm.
we just called it.
Just cut out that, and then we used to call our general a Hot Rock too. No.
I'm not sure about you, but the Navajo, I don't know, I got this out of language or something. That when the message went out, that you had to spell it out, you know, like, what was the word for S?
Yes. Well, we usually call it snake or sheep.
Yes, I knew
we had to have, we got an orphan ID.
Yes,
so
I know. I had the whole
thing. It would be confused, huh?
I know what
you're saying. It would be confused.
And so S was.
Shesh.
Uh-huh.
Shesh is an S. That
mm-hmm.
I'm going to use that.
Would you, for me, say, in Navajo, just as you would have said,